Tuesday, May 6th. This is Studio 2. Welcome. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry, did you get an invite to the Met Gala last night?
No.
You didn't?
Although, I hope one day I get to go.
You want to go.
Like one day.
Yeah, no, yeah. You'll get there. I believe in you.
Thank you.
My invite, I think it keeps going to my spam filter or something. I've never gotten one.
Yeah. I can't wait. I hope you go one day and I get to see Avi Wolfman Arendt dressed up.
No.
Spit shined for this.
No, I won't dress up because this is the problem with the Met Gala. Can I tell you?
Tell me.
Everyone is so beautiful and so well dressed that relative to one another, they don't pop as much. What you need is every 20th person to be a schlub. Just like a fill-in schlub.
But I feel like you would be a blinged out schlub, though.
No. It'd be t-shirt, corn in my teeth, just looking like a total schlub. And then next to me...
You'll add the corn. Okay.
And then next to me, Sofia Vergara looks even better. Yeah, you know what I mean? Jalen Hurts was there.
So you're giving them a boost.
They'd look even better. They should invite me to the Met Gala. I'm serious about it. This is a Met Gala. Hit me up.
Stop
going to the spam filter. I'll give you the direct line. A little levity to start the program today because we have a serious discussion today. Two major hospital closures in Delaware County. Those hospitals were owned by a private equity firm. And so today we're going to interrogate the role of private equity in healthcare and hospitals specifically. So our question for you, how have hospital closures in recent years impacted you? Also, if you have thoughts on private equity and healthcare, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat.
Yeah, and let me just tell you quickly, I covered a hospital closure a few years ago, and there's a wide community impact. I mean, you got people losing their jobs, people lose their doctors, you got doctors and nurses moving elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so there is a ripple effect, and I look forward to hearing from our listeners and how these closures have impacted them. We've lost a lot of hospitals in Pennsylvania over the years. 888-477-9499.
Trio of local news stories, Cherry, and the first one actually has to do with healthcare and bankruptcy, believe it or not.
Yeah, the Philadelphia-based pharmacy chain Rite Aid has filed for bankruptcy for the second time in less than 2 years. And now they are planning to sell or close all of the remaining stores. Mm. Yes, this decision follows continued financial challenges exacerbated by changing retail and healthcare landscapes. That's according to the CEO, Matt Schroeder. Now, Rite Aid will continue providing prescription services, vaccinations, and product sales. But at this point, they're starting to transfer those prescriptions to other pharmacies. And I mean, this company was founded 60 years ago. It's based in the Navy Yard right here in Philadelphia.
Which is recent. It used to be near Harrisburg, and they moved it here, and now they're closing.
And now they're closing. They have about 100 stores remaining in the Philadelphia region. But in my neighborhood, we have this zombie, you know, Rite Aid that used to be open and now it's just empty. They stripped off the name.
Yeah.
And by the way, that 100 number is 40% fewer than just 2022. And so this is happening. It's real time and people will have less access and ease of getting prescriptions in their neighborhood.
Doing a little background reading just on the state of the drugstore industry. And there had been over the last few decades, a massive consolidation and the corporate chains had really wiped out the independent pharmacies. And now it seems like perhaps there was some overextension and now they're retreating back. And then you have this competition from the online pharmacies or providers. And so is that the way it's going to move where instead of going to a pharmacy, you get a lot of stuff sent to you? So a lot of change going on in that industry right now. And this is just one symptom of all of that change.
Yeah. But by the way, the signs have been there for a while. I mean, if you went to a Rite Aid, there was like nothing in the store.
It was bleak.
Couldn't get cold and flu and all kinds of stuff.
Even like the soda shelf would be
empty.
No doubt. Mm-hmm. Okay, story number two. You're going to have to hang with me on this one because...
Break it down, Avi.
It's a complicated story that has been provoking a lot of chatter in our region over the weekend. So, an anti-Semitic sign at a Philly bar over the weekend has triggered a sprawling controversy that includes a Temple student and one of the country's biggest sports media companies. So the company in question is Barstool Sports. If you don't know them, they're very big in the podcast space, social media. I would say that even they would say they have a very bro-y vibe. That's kind of their brand. They happen to own a bar in Philadelphia. Now, at this bar over the weekend, some customers ordered what's known as bottle service, which comes with the ability to create a custom message on a light-up sign that gets held in the air. So some customers got bottle service at this bar owned by Barstool, and they asked for and received an explicitly anti-Semitic message displayed on the sign, and video of that message then went viral. So that's chapter one. And I'll just say for clarification here, there is a lot of debate right now. What is anti-Semitic? What isn't? This particular message,
it was clearly,
it's definitely in the anti-Semitic camp. So chapter two. The owner of Barstool, a guy named Dave Portnoy, who is Jewish, goes on the record and says he fired the people involved at the bar with this incident, and that he's spoken to the folks who ordered the sign, this anti-Semitic sign, including a temple student, and he said that they're very contrite and he wants to use this as a teaching moment. He's going to send them on a paid vacation, a trip to Auschwitz to learn more about the Holocaust. And then Temple suspends the student involved.
Yeah.
That's chapter two. Chapter three, Portnoy says the Temple student is no longer contrite and claims that he was not even the one who requested this anti-Semitic sign. So he's revoking the trip to Auschwitz. That's chapter three. Chapter four, if you're still with me, 6ABC, our news partner, interviews this guy, Dave Portnoy, owner of Barstool Sports. That interview has not aired, but Portnoy himself posted a video that someone took of him berating the reporter doing the interview. So let's hear a clip of that.
I'm the journalist. I'm asking. Well, I don't play by those rules. What does that mean? You're a journalist? I'm a journalist. I run a big media organization. I just asked you a question. I asked you a question. You answer the question. You answer the question.
You're not running this interview.
All right, then the interview's over.
There he goes. Angrily slams the laptop. Barstool, by the way, has been accused of posting edgy content that veers into misogyny and racism. Portnoy himself was once accused of sexual assault in an Insider.com investigation. So that's where things stand now. Everyone very mad and still some confusion about what actually happened here, other than the fact that clearly this sign was posted.
Yeah, I mean, Portnoy, big personality here, and probably, I don't know if it made the situation better, some of his reactions there, but that server clearly made an egregious error. Like, why would you allow that sign to exist? And then as a young person, the Temple student, why would you record it and then post it on social media?
Right, right.
By the way, that server also worked at Dance Express in Narberth, and they lost their job there as well. So there's so many ripple effects here. And I should mention that, you know, all of this comes as anti-Semitism is on the rise. In 2024, there were 465 anti-Semitic incidents reported in Pennsylvania, an 18% increase from 2023. And so that number just keeps growing. So something needs to happen to sort of, you know, I guess damper some of this.
Let's go to a media story now that we can celebrate. Story number three, Cherry.
So the Pulitzer Prize announcements dropped this week, and the late, great Philadelphia Daily News columnist Chuck Stone was awarded a special citation for his groundbreaking coverage of the civil rights movement.
Chuck Stone.
Yes. And if you've never heard of Chuck Stone, let me just tell you, he was a remarkable journalist, the first Black columnist at the Philadelphia Daily News. He is also one of the founders and architects of the Association of Black Journalists in Philadelphia, and also the National Association of Black Journalists, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. He is
very influential.
Yeah,
figure,
very
Chuck
influential.
Stone.
From St. Louis, was a Tuskegee Airman.
Yep.
In World War II, before going on to college, he became a journalist in the 50s, was very outspoken, worked for the Black press. He was a White House correspondent for the Washington Afro-American, and he reflected on that time in this comment while he was a professor at the University of North Carolina. Take a listen.
I admired him enormously. He's one of the few people. I cry when he was killed. I cry when Martin Luther King was killed. But Kennedy was a hero of mine. And those 2.5 years as White House correspondent was one of the most enriching, intellectually enriching experiences I've ever had.
And there he's talking about President John F. Kennedy at the time. By the way, Chuck Stone had a huge personality and people trusted him because he was unapologetic. He was raw. He would criticize the police department, politicians. He was an equal opportunity columnist.
Yeah, a lot of barbs.
A lot of barbs.
And one of the most amazing things about Chuck Stone is that when there were people who were wanted by the police,
yeah,
very often they would turn themselves into Chuck Stone because mm-hmm. they trusted him.
More than the police. Yeah.
And Stone would facilitate sort of a linkage with the police department. And in fact, he helped kind of quell a major prison riot. Mm-hmm. He was like the mediator, which is just an amazing thing to think of. It speaks both to his power, mm-hmm. but also the power of the mainstream press in that time that he could have such influence.
Yeah. And by the way, 70 people over the years turned themselves in or surrendered to Chuck Stone through those years. And once he left in 1991, he left the Daily News in 1991, a lot of that stopped.
Yeah.
And he went on to be a professor at
Chuck Stone trivia fact.
Yeah.
His son, who's also named Charles Stone III, directed Drumline.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
And was the guy behind the Budweiser Was Up commercials.
Very cool.
He's a Philadelphian as well. So he's had a very interesting career. So there is still a Charles Stone out there doing interesting work. Yeah. So I just wanted to add that. But nice moment for the Daily News, for Chuck Stone, his whole family.
And for NABJ, there are thousands of black journalists who are working together because of Chuck Stone, one of the founders.
Coming up on Studio 2, we're going to talk about hospital closures, two big ones recently in Delaware County. We want to know how hospital closures have impacted you. Give us a call, 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Crozier Chester Medical Center in Upland closed its doors last week, and it's the last Crozier Hospital to shutter after owner Prospect Medical Holdings, a private equity firm, declared bankruptcy and failed to find a buyer. Delaware County residents will no longer have close access to the major medical system, which included the only regional trauma center. Plus, thousands of people are now out of work.
If this story sounds familiar to Philadelphians, well, it should. Center City's Hahnemann Hospital closed in 2019, 1 year after it was bought by a private equity firm. Private equity has been investing heavily in healthcare. Nearly 500 hospitals are PE-owned, not to mention all the physician practices, nursing homes, fertility centers, and rehab clinics. So what is the impact of private equity on patient care, access, and efficiency? Critics say private equity puts profits over patients, but PE firms say they bring innovation and cost-cutting to outdated and bloated health systems. Joining us now to talk about the role of private equity in healthcare and what it means for all of us is Yasha Swinney-Singh, a healthcare economist at Brown University, and Kenny Cooper, WHYY Suburban reporter covering the Crozier Health System closures. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and for our listeners at home, our question for you today is this: how have hospital closures in recent years impacted you? And have you seen private equity impact your health care? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for our studio tubers listening online, be sure to drop your comments or questions in the chat. And so we wanted to start this conversation with you, Kenny. We're talking about that latest closure, Chester Medical Center. Walk us through and give us the Cliff's Notes version of how we go from it getting purchased to now shuttering its doors.
Right. So just for background, Prospect Medical Holdings, California-based for-profit company. It owns hospitals across several states, including Connecticut, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, California, obviously. And I think this story kind of starts back even prior to when Prospect was came through to purchase Crozier in 2016. Crozier Health, largest employer in Delaware County, 6,000 people at its highest, right? So you're talking about a system that not only provided care for huge portions of Delaware County, but also sustained it as a major employer. So when Prospect comes in, they're not coming in with like a clean slate of Crozier Health in this perfect condition. Crozier Health was kind of distressed, and it wasn't in the greatest position financially. But I don't think if you went back in time to 2016 and told people that these hospitals were going to be gone, that people would say that they'd be gone within 10 years. And that's what happened. You had a complete strip down of a system, not only of its assets, of its health care, of its employees, but I think also, more broadly speaking, of a community cornerstone, a community fixture. Even just describing the city of Chester and the area of Upland, borough of Upland, where Chester Medical Center was operating at, right? The city of Chester infamously does not have a private practice physician that operates within city limits. So you're talking a hospital. You're talking about a hospital that a lot of people were using for primary care. It was a really important fixture for a lot of people, and now it's gone because of a series of private equity decisions.
And what were those decisions? And again, we're doing the Cliff Notes version of this,
yes.
But you said stripped down. Like, what does that mean?
So the Cliff Notes version of this is you have this private equity firm, Leonard Green & Partners, that comes in to Prospect. And really their goal is to maximize profits, but not necessarily maximize profits for the entire system, but to absorb huge dividends in the forms of hundreds of millions of dollars in payouts and dividends to their investors and to Prospect's own executives. So within a series of years, Prospect essentially begins the process of giving away its assets, or dividends rather, to these executives. And in order to pay out these huge dividends, they didn't have to turn to itself and basically drain itself of its own assets, both in the form of loans, and then in these things called leaseback agreements, where they're essentially selling the property that these hospitals exist on to real estate investment trusts, right? And they're essentially now paying rent. So, okay, it's just like, okay.
So they used to own the land.
Yeah.
And then they sell it.
And then they sell it.
And they get the cash from that deal.
Then they get the cash from that deal, but now they're forced
to
pay rent.
Now
they're renting the land.
Got it.
Right?
Which is adding to the expenses of the hospital.
It's adding to the expenses of the hospital, but it also dramatically decreases the value of the entire asset. Because who wants to buy something where you're paying rent? Right? So anyone that would have to come in would now also have to figure out, hey, what am I going to do with this rent situation? I don't necessarily own the building.
And they did at one point, they tried for a while to find buyers, right? And
yes.
And basically no one wanted this asset.
Yes.
Or didn't want it enough.
So the first prospective buyer that came in that was interested was ChristianaCare, which is based in Delaware. They took a look under the hood. They didn't like what they saw. They even got as far as to signing a letter of intent. They backed out of the deal.
Got it.
The next group to come in was CHA Partners, which was a New Jersey-based real estate firm. They came in 2024, took a look under the hood, didn't like what they saw. They backed out, right? And then this most recent group of nonprofit consortium group of prospective buyers or whatever they may be, owners that would come in and take over the system, two sides just couldn't come to an agreement, meaning Prospect and this group of buyers. So what you have is a system that they tried over and over again to offload to other people, but it grew more unattractive, not in just the sense that, hey, it's, you know, there's rent that we have to pay over this property and all this kind of stuff, but just the degradation of the buildings themselves, right?
Yeah.
This is a system that was, you know, neglected, both in terms of the unpaid bills, the actual physical infrastructure crumbling apart.
Yeah.
It grows more unattractive each year.
And so now this doesn't sound good, but we want to find out a little bit more about private equity. And we'll get back to you in just a moment, Kenny. So Yasha Swinney Singh, we want to bring you into the conversation because a lot of us are hearing this term private equity. We have no idea what that means. Could you just give us a primer on this? Like, what exactly is private equity and why would they want to buy a hospital in the first place?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. I should say, you know, it's great to be part of this conversation. It's certainly an important one and a timely one. Private equity generally refers to firms that are private in nature who invest in other private firms. Now, private equity has had an expansive presence in the U.S. economy for a very long time, and healthcare has emerged as an interesting, lucrative target for PE only recently. So over the last decade or so, we've seen private equity firms invest about $1 trillion in the American healthcare system. And investments range every setting from cradle to grave, right? And so this can range from, as you mentioned earlier, fertility services, primary care services, investments in hospitals, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and so on. The key thing to remember here is that they are financial investors who are seeking to make a short-term profit on their investment. A lot of the time, PE investments are often accompanied by large amounts of debt. So historically, these have also been called leveraged buyouts because the transaction value is often funded by borrowed money. Often 60 to 90% of the transaction value is often funded via debt, which, as we've mentioned in this case of Crozier, can result in large debt burdens being placed on the hospital, in addition to the hospital needing to make rental payments on real estate that it previously owned.
Okay, so you said there's been this increase in interest from private equity, and you said they're focused on short-term profits. What does that translate to, generally speaking, in terms of how a hospital is run once it's acquired by a private equity firm? Like, do we see categorical, qualitative differences in how those hospitals are run versus other for-profit hospitals or even not-for-profit hospitals?
I mean, that's such a great question, right? Because for-profit ownership and private ownership in healthcare is certainly not new to the American healthcare system, but private equity adds sort of an amplifying force to the incentives that already exist, right? And so it's a $1 trillion question, literally, because that's the money at stake. And thankfully, we don't need to guess the answer because, academic researchers such as myself and others have spent a lot of time trying to understand what are the effects of PE investments in healthcare. So I can tell you in brief, when PE firms invest in hospitals, a lot changes, right? So again, the driving force is that firms need to deliver returns to their investors. This happens through a few different channels, right? So you think about increasing revenues. One way that PE firms succeed in increasing revenues of hospitals they invest in is by changing the service mix or service offerings that communities have access to. So in brief, you know, they can increase the provision of really profitable service lines like MRIs and CT scans, diagnostic imaging. And at the same time, hospitals have been shown in the research to cut back on services that might be critical from a patient's perspective, like maternity services, but might not be best for the bottom line.
But can I just ask a clarifying question there, Yasha Swinney? So you said it's amplifying, but what I take away from that is that other types of hospitals would make these same types of moves, investing in profitable services, divesting from less profitable services. But that in a PE run hospital or owned hospital, this might happen quicker or more aggressively? Is that the idea?
That's exactly right. Okay. So these changes might happen, over a quicker period of time, but also in a more aggressive fashion, because in general, investors are in it for the short run. We've also seen, you can drive profitability by increasing revenues, but you can also drive profitability by cutting back on costs. Mm-hmm. And in healthcare, the largest cost by far for any setting is that tied to hiring and retaining talented staff, right? Staff costs are often the most expensive costs in healthcare. And so there we've seen that when PE firms invest in hospitals and other settings of care, workforce composition changes as a lot of staff turnover and retention issues and reduction in how much hospitals spend on salary expenditure and so on. And so all of this raises questions about what it means for patient care, right? Not only do patients not have access to services that might be critical, they might also have fewer people taking care of them. And this has direct and significant impacts for patient outcomes and patient care experiences.
I want to bring in a caller. We have Peggy on line 10. She is a resident nurse at Crozier Chester Medical Center and the president of the Crozier Chester Nurses Association, spent a couple of decades working there. Peggy, you spent some time working at Crozier Chester. Tell us, what was it like before Prospect purchased the medical system, and what was it like after?
I think the biggest thing is that before Prospect Medical came in, the focus was always the patient and the care of the patient. After Prospect Medical came in, very quickly, we realized that it was about money and the dollar and the bottom line. They stopped referring to patients as patients, but we talked about bed flow and throughput. And we kind of took the human connection out of healthcare when they came in. And it was very clear very early on that this was no longer about taking care.
Peggy, were there things other than changes in terminology that keyed you on to that shift in focus?
Sure. I mean, very quickly, we saw a change in the quality of our supplies and limited supplies. and everyone was limited during COVID, but we were extremely limited. And again, the quality, you know, we know they bought everything super cheap. Like the soap has no scent, you know, just small things like that. But they're the things that are important when you're caring for a patient, is to be able to give them quality care and have, you know, effective and well, good working supplies. We saw they did not repair equipment. We spent a lot of time piecemealing equipment for EKGs and things of that nature, where we would have to go from unit to unit to kind of gather supplies and makeshift everything. We saw that happen really quickly, too. They just didn't maintain anything. Our ancillary staff, the numbers of our ancillary staff and all of our staff dropped really quickly. So we had higher numbers of patients with less ancillary staff to be able for us to properly care for these patients. And so, you know, your incident of bed sores and hospital acquired pneumonia, those kind of things, I am sure the studies will show increased in this time frame, because without enough staff, you cannot properly care for these patients.
And so, Peggy, now that Crozier Chester Medical Center is closed, you work there. How has this impacted your life, and sort of what are your plans now that this medical center that you spent so much time at is no longer?
Well, the entire staff is devastated, and I just want to make it clear that at the time of the closure, we had almost 200 patients, and we had a staff of over 2,700 people. We have seen this happen over the course of 9 years, yet nobody left. Everyone knew that this was a possibility, but the commitment of the staff at Crozier is something like I've never seen, and I think is what I'm most proud of. And we had an event Friday, they closed us so quickly, we had a quick kind of a going away party on the lot. And what every single person there said is, if we reopen, I will be back or I will stay. And so our staff are having, a lot of people are having trouble getting jobs. There are not a lot of jobs out there. There are not a lot of nursing jobs in the local vicinity. So people are really having trouble. So I think our focus still has to be reopening. I think that has to be the biggest piece of this puzzle, that we have to reopen, because remember, we've said the same thing over and over again. The population that we serve, transportation is not easy. Access to healthcare is not easy. And so they have nowhere to go. They shut down the doors and they put signs on the doors that said we're closed without giving anybody any type of resources. The physician's offices are closed. People can't get their prescriptions. This was done in rapid speed. And so I think our biggest focus right now in this whole community and this whole country is reopening this hospital.
And thank you so much, Peggy, resident nurse at Crozier Chester Medical Center and president of the Crozier Chester Nurses Association. Lots of passion there as they deal with this closure.
Yeah, we appreciate her time so much, especially during this turbulent time. Let me read this email from Maura in Ridley Park, who says, I live 8 blocks away from Taylor Hospital, which was closed, and seeing the impact it is having on my community is devastating. Our next closest hospitals are over 5 miles away. Everyone is scrambling for new doctors. We've lost all ambulatory services except the firehouse paramedics. In a life or death situation, it's not looking good for us here. That's Maura in Ridley Park. Yeah, what is the situation on the ground now, Kenny Cooper, if people have an emergency in Delaware County? What's the triage situation?
So the next closest hospitals for people that live in Southern Delaware County are Riddle Hospital in Media and Mercy Fitzgerald Hospital in Darby. The issue is that those two hospitals, while they may be fine hospitals in and of themselves, aren't high-level trauma centers. So if someone is shot, someone is having a major, major health incident, you know, if there's a major crash on I-95, they're not likely to go to those hospitals. So instead, they have to go much farther for care. They have to go to a higher-level trauma care center, which is 30 minutes or more away. You're talking Penn Presbyterian in Philadelphia. You're talking Lincoln Isle Medical Center on the main line. You're talking even going down.
Yeah, that's quite a haul to get to Lincoln.
If you're having a major trauma, those minutes count.
Exactly. Those minutes count. So when you talk to paramedics, you talk to EMTs, this is their biggest concern, is these worst-case scenarios that may sound rare but actually happen quite frequently.
Let me ask you a sort of quick follow-up because Peggy mentioned the possibility of reopening. Is that seriously on the table right now? I know some state legislators are involved. There's been a foundation that has been sort of orbiting this situation. Are the prospects for that good, bad, somewhere in between? What's your read?
Not very likely. In fact, probably not likely at all. So Prospect is bankrupt. They're in the middle of these bankruptcy court proceedings. It doesn't appear likely that this will just suddenly reappear on the docket, right? So this is kind of, for them, in hindsight, and that is why there was just so much, you know, attention paid over these last few weeks, because people knew that once you kind of miss this window, the chances of it reopening are drastically decreased. I mean, we saw two hospitals close in Chester County, Brandywine Hospital and Jennersville Hospital, and neither of them have reopened yet.
Yeah.
And now we want to bring in State Senator Timothy Carney, a Democrat representing Delaware County's 26th District, who has been involved in the fight to keep Crozier open and in legislative efforts to bar private equity from buying hospitals. Senator Carney, welcome to Studio 2.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
And so you've been listening to this conversation. And so I know you were part of a delegation of folks from Delaware County that has been asking the state attorney general to step in and claw back some of the resources that were pumped into the medical system to try to keep it open and to find a buyer. Where does that stand right now?
Well, it's a very difficult position, as Kenny was describing earlier. And I certainly get what Peggy was saying. And, you know, we've been standing with her for years now about all these particular issues. I think the thing to keep in mind is that this has been happening like a train wreck in slow motion over the last 2 years, you know, from when Delaware County Memorial first closed. Actually, it's when Delaware County Memorial first closed their obstetrics unit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then they put a sign on the door that tell women which two buses to take to get down to Crozier. But now they're at a point where there is no Crozier. And the legislation that we're doing now is really, unfortunately, is not going to do anything to remedy this actual situation. It's really to prevent this from happening in the future.
Can we talk about that legislation, what exactly it would do? I mean, I've seen lots of different proposals floating around. What proposal are you really putting your weight behind? If you sort of could pick a thing to push through, what would it be and what would it do?
Well, the one that we're primarily focused on right now is a bill which would give the Attorney General standing and a level of oversight over any major transaction that occurs within a hospital system. So what we've, and that's because when we first introduced legislation 3 years ago around this, it was very raw at the time. It was, you know, around, and we were, it was a very emotional sort of bill. We were able to step back from that and kind of reassess and do our due diligence. And what we really found was that anytime there was a major transaction that occurred within a hospital system, invariably within 2 years, something terrible happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point of this bill is to give people like the Attorney General, who have the resources and have the expertise on this, to really try to make a decision as to whether a transaction is actually in the public interest.
Would you describe it as a type of veto power that the AG would have? I mean, what power would they have when we're on the verge of a future sale?
Well, I think they could hold up a sale essentially by going to court.
Got it.
So that's the remedy that really, the only kind of remedy that makes sense within existing Pennsylvania law.
Yeah. And I want to just ask you this wider trend, because in the past 20 years or so, I mean, 32 hospitals in Pennsylvania have closed. That's according to stats I've read. And I know that these sales sort of happen at some point close in proximity to these closures. What do you want to see happen? And how have you seen these closures sort of impact and have a ripple effect across the state?
You know, we are just now beginning to see the very first repercussions from the Crozier closing. You know, we're seeing Riddle Hospital, for example, has a 40% increase in their emergency room. And I think that will only get worse because of proximity. And when you look at the sort of heat maps for healthcare in the southern part of the county, it's atrocious. We literally have a healthcare desert down there. And it's compounded by the fact that we don't have the support staff even. You know, that there are no family doctors who have offices in Chester. There's 75% of the people who use the emergency room at Crozier were not admitted to a hospital. And that basically points out the fact that they were basically using it, you know, as their primary care place, which is crazy in and of itself.
I do think we have to let you go, but I want to thank you so much for your time, Senator Tim Carney, State Senator of the 26th District in Delaware County, part of a coalition of lawmakers trying to craft some legislation in response to these closures. Senator Carney, thanks so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Sure. Thank you, Abby. Okay.
And Frank emails pointing exactly to that legislation, saying, I guess, Frank, that supports that idea of having empowering the AG to potentially do more in the future. Emily writes in and says, I'm one of the 3,000 staff who was laid off. I'm an occupational therapist who worked at Springfield Hospital since 2007. I saw Prospect slowly close departments. Greediness from Prospect sucked our hospital system dry. I'm so sad for my patients who I was in the middle of treating when we learned on Monday that we would be closing on Friday. That's an email from Emily. So keep those comments and calls coming. We want to expand a little bit on the other side of this break,
future.
Just to talk about the future of private equity in healthcare and dissect more of upsides and downsides. So keep those emails coming. Studio2@whyy.org. The number is 888-477-9499.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. If you are just joining us, we're talking about the role of private equity in healthcare. We just saw the closure of the Crozier Health System in Delaware County, which is owned by a private equity company. Private equity has become a sort of boogeyman in all sorts of industries, accused of putting profits above all else. Is that the story in healthcare? And if it is, what does that mean for all of us? Since private equity is buying more hospitals, physician practices, dialysis centers, rehab clinics, and nursing homes.
And let me reintroduce our guests. We have Yasha Swinney Singh, healthcare economist and assistant professor at Brown University with us. We also have WHYY suburban reporter Kenny Cooper in our Philadelphia studio. And our question for you, our listeners at home, is this: how have hospital closures in recent years impacted you? What do you think about private equity investment in healthcare? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching online, be sure to leave your question or comment in the chat.
I want to turn this back over to you, Yasha Swinney, because you had a really nice breakdown of what happens when a PE firm purchases a hospital. Seems like everything that might have happened happens a little faster. But that doesn't necessarily mean if they hadn't purchased that hospital, if it was in decline, that it wouldn't have eventually closed, even for-profit or not-for-profit. So is it fair to lay hospital closures at the feet of this increased activity from PE firms, or is that a bridge too far?
That's a great question, right? And I must start by saying every private equity acquisition is different, right? Every investment is different. Every hospital is different. The financial history is different. So just with that caveat, certainly the academic research that has found some of these effects of PE has done so comparing PE-owned hospitals to a comparison group or a control group of hospitals that look very similar to acquired hospitals, except that they're not acquired by private equity. And so, you know, from a research design lens, that concern is accounted for. There are also specific practices that PE firms can deploy when they invest in hospitals. We talked already about real estate leasebacks and other sort of financial maneuverings that can leave hospitals particularly vulnerable, especially after investors have exited. And so, you know, while I acknowledge that there are a lot of complexities in the American healthcare system that make healthcare providers and hospitals vulnerable financially, PE certainly is not helping, right? We're adding fuel to the fire here. And the sort of sole incentive the primary incentive is to serve the interests of investors rather than the communities that hospitals serve.
And I want to ask this question. We got this email from William.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. This is a great question. Yeah.
And this is a question that gets to the reasons why hospitals would sell. And William says, why would the hospital sell to the private equity outfits in the first place? So what makes private equity even an attractive seller to hospitals or any of these medical organizations that are then handing their patients' future over to these firms?
So we must remember that the practice of medicine in the United States is incredibly complex. And in general, independent practitioners just aren't cut out to practice medicine, you know, with its ever-changing regulatory compliance requirements and investments in electronic health records and so on. So there's a very real need for private capital and private investment that PE firms are seeking to fill. Some would also say that there are so many redundancies and sort of frustrating attributes of the American healthcare system that PE, with its emphasis on streamlining operations, can make things a little bit better, right? Make things a little bit performance-oriented, make things a little bit more efficient. You know, how that plays out for the patient and the healthcare worker is still unfolding. But there are, you know, proponents would say there are very real arguments for why there's a need for private investment because, you know, things are underfunded. Primary care is one example where, you know, primary care has been historically underfunded for decades, if not longer. And PE firms often offer a lifeline to doctors and say, you know, we'll help you modernize your practice environment, invest in the billing records that you need to then compete for complicated contracts and so on. And it's a great question because it reminds us of the other side of the coin, right? No forcing hospitals or doctor practices to enter into these partnerships. And so understanding what motivates them and what sort of problem is PE seeking to solve can help us then figure out if there's an easier way to offer that lifeline without requiring doctors or hospitals to partner with financial investors of this nature.
Yeah, and that leads me to the question, because I'm sure lots of people listening are thinking, all right, simple solution. Let's just make sure private equity firms cannot make these types of purchases, however you would legislate that. And then the question becomes, okay, so if you take them and their money out of the ecosystem, what happens? So there's fewer buyers potentially for every hospital that wants to sell. There's fewer buyers for every practice that wants to sell or to liquidate or whatever. I mean, so what happens if you take PE and that type of investment vehicle out of the healthcare ecosystem?
You know, arose by any other name, right? So truly another investor, maybe we won't call it PE, but the incentives will still exist. And so I want to be clear here that, you know, calls to regulate any specific type of financial investor or financial form or financial entity are a little bit misguided because what PE firms are doing in healthcare and in other sectors are exploiting existing incentives that exist within the very lawful kind of regulatory environment, right? And so as an economist and policy researcher, a lot of our work suggests that the right policy response is to fix the incentives that any PE firms can exploit. But certainly PE is just one form of corporatization in the American healthcare system. So rather than regulating private equity, let's just regulate the incentives that firms can use to their advantages at the cost of patients and healthcare workers.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments. Bruce emailed, I think this conversation is missing the point. Everyone will need healthcare. The United States is the only first world country that doesn't offer a basic healthcare for its citizens. National healthcare is what is needed. And I want to bring in a caller because Dan is from Westchester, has been on the line for a while, has a personal experience with private equity. Dan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I had a very negative experience with private equity buying out a gastroenterology suite or business that I had been a patient at for over 20 years. I called to schedule an appointment only because rather than go through the normal channels, because I was diagnosed with a heart condition. I'm 78 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm a disabled vet. I've got a bunch of stuff going wrong at the same time. And I knew instinctively that if anybody was going to perform that kind of procedure on my body, they'd want to know about my heart condition. When I contacted them, they said, no, you're not allowed to talk to a physician. Physicians are restricted to performing their duties in surgical suites. I did some online research. I discovered the name of the organization.
fact that they were taken over by a private equity firm in Exton, Pennsylvania, and that just soured me entirely. And, you know, after arguing back and forth, I gave up and just went to a different place. Mm.
Thank you. That's Dan from Westchester. We hear Dan's experience, very sour, not good. I want to ask you, Kenny Cooper, I mean, you've talked about what's left for the folks. We heard Peggy talk about it a little bit, the nurse that was there. What's going to happen with all these folks who no longer have their primary care physicians at Crozier? What's going to happen to the folks? And is there an effort to sort of link them with new medical providers?
So let me start with the good news. Yes, the county is working really hard to kind of fill in these gaps. So these gaps in emergency care, whether it be like with ambulances, these gaps in mental health care. The county is working on the other end to kind of connect people with these different services that are a little bit more niche than you would get from a primary care provider or even from another hospital, right? I think the bad side of this is that a lot of this is more of a time will tell situation, right? This is an area that has kind of been long forgotten. It's not the main line, right? And when I say long forgotten, meaning that I think that if this did happen somewhere else where people were a little bit more wealthier, had a little bit more access to their elected officials, had a little bit more of a voice, then I think people probably would have been raising the alarm on this issue
and
10 years ago.
Tell people a little bit about this community because, you know, just
yeah,
in case
I mean,
you
this
don't
is
know.
This is just Southern Delco. This is what you think of as Delco, right? This is a working middle class area, right? Where a lot of people are either employed at these hospitals, employed in local areas. You know, this is Delco, right? And I think the fact that, you know, these hospitals were able to close in this manner, I think has really soured a lot of people and kind of makes them feel isolated, like no one's actually listening to them. You know, when I talk to some of these nurses or these doctors or some of the patients, people that work as elected officials in some of these boroughs and townships that are, you know, previously served by Crozier, a lot of them are just throwing their hands up. You know, they're throwing their hands up in both frustration from the fact that, you know, they've been sounding the alarm about this for years, but also in a sense that there is no immediate fix that you can do to remedy the situation other than opening the doors, but there's no money left.
Yeah. And Yasha Swinney, I have a quick follow-up for you related to what Kenny had to say. I mean, I think about the rural hospitals that have closed. You think about Hahnemann, which served a lot of low-income individuals. You think about Crozier Medical Center in a community that's primarily working class. Does private equity sort of target certain communities? I'm just wondering if this is part of the trend at all.
That's a good question. You know, what we've seen so far is that private equity firms have invested in about 500 hospitals, and they span both urban and rural markets, right? And so it seems kind of less divided along those lines. The one common denominator, though, is the use of real estate leasebacks. Mm-hmm. And this is a particularly interesting practice and strategy that firms can deploy, because what it does essentially is have hospitals get rid of their most valuable asset, right? The most valuable asset hospitals own, blocks and blocks of real estate in downtown Philadelphia for Hahnemann Hospital, now becomes the property of the private equity firm. So not only is the hospital saddled with debt, but they also have the privilege of paying rent on an asset that they previously owned. And so this just sets hospitals on a path to financial destruction. There was a bipartisan, I must note, bipartisan US Senate report on private equity investments in hospitals that came out in January of this year. And Crozier was one of the hospitals that report profiled. And I read in there that Crozier had to make rental payments of over $35 million a year. Now, that is money that could have been spent on hiring and retaining your talented clinical workforce. That is money that could be spent on improving the patient care experience. But sadly, it was money that was used to make rental payments on an asset the hospital already owned by itself. And so, you know, while the urban and rural divide, of course, there are serious implications, more so for rural entities. But the practice itself that leads hospitals to those positions is common, regardless of setting.
Speaking of real estate, Rob emailed us and is concerned about the historical site that used to be the Crozier Theological Seminary, from which Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. graduated. Mm-hmm. That is implicated in all of this, and Rob is worried about the future of that site. Before we go, Yasha Swinney, only a minute left, but you said we have to realign the incentives. It doesn't matter. We could take away PE. if the incentives stay the same, we're going to see a lot of the same outcomes. So how would you realign the incentives in hospitals and healthcare to prevent things like this from happening in the future?
So one thing that's been implicit in our conversation, but I'll just say it outright, is that there are no reporting or disclosure requirements for private equity transactions in healthcare. A lot of states have focused their efforts on increasing awareness and requiring ownership transparency. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? So you ask for better data on ownership entities that are involved in healthcare service delivery. And that has a lot of potential. Also, regulations that put greater authority in the state attorney general to require greater market oversight, so that somebody has a say in what's going on, particularly if it has the potential to shape everyone's lives.
Well, we do have to leave it there. And I want to thank all of our guests this hour. Really robust conversation.
Yes.
Thank you, Yasha Swinney Singh, healthcare economist and assistant professor at Brown University, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And of course, thank you, WHYY suburban reporter Kenny Cooper, with us in our Philadelphia studios. Always a pleasure to have you, Kenny. And thank you for all your reporting on this.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you to all of our callers and commenters. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2. Here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and we will talk to you tomorrow.